Welcome back to Crosstabs, the podcast about what polls really are and what they are not, a show designed to help you understand how the tools that measure and shape public opinion are built and wielded. I'm your host, Farah Bostic. I'm a strategist, researcher, and founder of The Difference Engine. This conversation is the last in a three-part series about some of the more technical aspects of survey research that affect anyone using online sample providers to source respondents to their studies. In this episode, I continue my conversation with Rich Ratcliffe, Chief Trust Officer at OpinionRoute, to talk about what happens now that we're in a world that looks a lot more like programmatic advertising than like the old world of person-to-person signups to participate in surveys. How do we detect the 10% of our sample that might be fraudulent? What resources do researchers need to detect fraud both within a single study and across the studies and surveys we conduct, or across the sample partners we select? How do we build for trust when there are people out there who are exploiting that trust? I got a couple of smart questions after last week's episode that I think might fill in some blanks for people who just don't do this all day. When we talked last time about how programmatic sample had improved feasibility, what we literally mean here is our ability to conduct the study at all. I do feasibility checks frequently, even for small studies, and the main question I'm asking is, how hard is it going to be for us to find this specific type of person? Can we find enough of them to fill our sample that will give us any level of confidence? Programmatic sample has made us less dependent on the people already screened into a double opt-in panel and more likely to find tough-to-reach segments of any audience. Another question is, what are we talking about when we say an insights platform? Most of the time, what we mean is essentially a research dashboard, but a good example might be SurveyMonkey or Qualtrics. These are platforms that allow you to construct a survey, select your respondent qualifications, deploy that survey to those respondents, frequently using their own sample system, collect data, and analyze it. And some of them have more robust tools for analysis than others, and some provide more robust tools for research ops that allow you to detect inauthentic or low-quality responses than others. So it all kind of depends, but in essence, what we're talking about with an insights platform is a research dashboard. The last one I want to try to put a finer point on is programmatic sample. The word programmatic here is really referring to the automation of buying and selling survey sample. It's kind of like an online brokerage of sample exchanges, and the sample providers are those brokers. Survey sample, in case you're wondering, is just people to take the surveys that you're writing. And typically we understand those people as being those who have signed up to take surveys for rewards or cash. However, some of those sources of sample are high quality. They are, in fact, people who've opted in. They've even been validated or verified in some way, and they want to participate in surveys. YouGov has a panel that functions in this way. Some of these sources are lower quality, like intercepting someone while using a website or playing a video game who didn't opt in to take surveys. They opted in to play Candy Crush. This is also called river sample. These brokers will buy and sell sample to each other. They will buy and sell sample from multiple sources, high quality and low quality. And this creates actually an interesting risk of respondent duplication. But the real thing to take away from here is that programmatic sample is the same kind of thing as buying programmatic advertising. It's all very automated. It's dependent on APIs all being linked up. And they also offer limited operational support to detect fraud, whether it be fraudulent respondents or fraudulent behavior. So those are just a couple of things that seem to need a little defining for people who don't work inside this industry. And if you have any questions about any of the terms or concepts that we discuss in any of these episodes, please get in touch. Send me an email, farah@crosstabspodcast.com, and I will happily answer them either in the newsletter or in a subsequent episode. I want to drive home one last time that the risk of fraud in market research in the marketing industry is kind of lowish stakes. Maybe it's just a waste of a few thousand dollars per project. But if you're relying on the quality of the data to be high to guide your strategic decision making, reliance on poor quality data can cost a lot more than that. It's also a relatively soft target in the realm of business, marketing, politics, journalism. With a coordinated attack on sample providers, fraud could significantly skew our understanding of public opinion, party affiliation, vote intention on the one hand, or brand preference, social attitudes, consumer behavior on the other. You won't be able to tell by the size of the sample or the name of the research firm or the sponsor of the research whether that data is trustworthy. Only researchers with security and quality controls in place will even be able to tell reliably that such an attack has taken place. So this conversation tries to focus more on how researchers can find the right partners with the right technology and experience to help them determine whether they are dealing with run-of-the-mill survey fraud or something much worse. And we talk about where we think the industry is headed as a result, what role governance, whether by contract or by regulation, is needed, and the extent to which researchers need to get involved once again in the subject of sample. So we are reconvening for part two of this conversation about what has happened to the sample industry. And I think where we left it last time was right as we had blown way past the amount of time I booked with you, I was asking you, why does all this matter? What are the stakes? And ultimately, I think one of the earliest conversations you and I had was that this is a thing that people like me who do research tend not to pay a ton of close attention to, like the underlying source of sample or sample quality, all of those things. We sort of trust our sample providers to give us what we need, and we trust our quantitative partners to know how to work with that if we're qualitative research like I am. And that's the extent to which we've been paying attention to that. But it is clear that researchers need to be more aware of what's going on here. And frankly, I don't know if they need to get as worked up as I got about it, but they do need to be concerned. Maybe let's talk about why that is. What do you think are the stakes for researchers? Why should we be paying closer attention to what's going on?
One of the things that happens with researchers is you get trained to do research. You get trained to design the capability of getting insights in a way that's unbiased and representative. And that last key word is pretty important to this, right? You do everything you can in sort of that primary research approach to find the people that represent the research that you need to take care of. And for a very long time, the way that you could do that is just go find the people and recruit them to do the survey. And you knew that you knew who Jack Smith was. You had a pretty good idea where they lived, and you knew from that point what you were working with. That's all the way back before we had computers. So you had a list of people that you were going door to door, or you had a list of people that you were calling, but you always knew that there was sort of this physical binding to them in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. As we moved to online, we still felt that was the case. And in fact, that's the way that most market research companies went, is that they went to a panel and they went to the structure that worked for the idea of that panel, which is recruit the person, make sure that they validate, make sure that they take surveys, they enjoy their experiences, and it was a win for both parties. When that business model started to find its way towards getting outgrown by the demand, silently, researchers had that rug pulled out from under them. The sample companies all along said that this was what they were doing. Those just researchers didn't know how to speak that language, didn't know exactly what the implications were when all of this was happening. And the only researchers that really understood it were ones that had either stepped foot into the sample industry, pulled out, stepped foot into a space that was close to that, like advertising, and then understood what people meant by clicks and conversion rates and banners and the convenience world that we live in today. There is no physical binding here. That's one of the areas that causes researchers to really need to, I wouldn't say reclaim that physical binding. I think it's too expensive, and it would really be a bit of an earthquaking moment if they attempted to do that today. But that gets us to, what do we do from here, right? Because when it's physical binding, there's still a validation process that happens, right? Mm-hmm. When it was phone, you'd call 10% of the people and make sure that 10% of the people said, yeah, I took the survey. When it was community and it was sort of a double opt-in process, you could do the same thing. You could email them and say, can you answer this question? And you can match the answers and do some type of validation to that. You can't necessarily do that today. You got to be really careful with that whole process. So what you then have to do is start to think about what is surrounding the virtual space that could be the Achilles heel to modern day research. And a very large portion of that is the inauthentic nature of what happens in digital. It's the person acting in an inauthentic way, meaning they're taking the survey in a poor manner. That's just a poor participation. Mm-hmm. But there's also inauthentic identity and authentic behavior in the sense that you're trying to manipulate what's going on. And then there's inauthentic representativeness. Like any other industry, you got to look at another industry to see where's the parallels play out. A lot of the parallels that are playing out today have to do with how the banking industry specifically has dealt with fraud. The consumer of today understands that they need to deal with fraud, which is pretty obvious. Oh, yeah, I've got a fraudulent charge. I'm going to appeal that charge. The bank takes it off. Everybody's happy, including the fraudster, because the fraudster got what they wanted. And you hope that over time they get caught. The retailer, if they are consistently causing fraud to happen, that means that they are not putting up the protective measures they need to, and they become a hotbed of fraud. Now, there are obviously fraud that's happening in the physical world as well. It's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But if we sort of look at that parallel, it changes your perspective about how fraud needs to happen, and it will happen in everything we do moving forward, right? So how do they deal with it? Well, they do everything they possibly can, given the landscape that they can see, and that's each party. Mm-hmm. That means that the researcher really needs to think about how fraud or the prevention of fraud needs to play out in their research. And you can see it playing out in elementary ways, but in many cases, because of those elementary ways, and it's the only hammer they can swing, you see too much of it. A good example of that is the sort of overt nature of red herrings and catch me if you can questions that play out with those.
Mm-hmm.
Those have an adverse effect to your research in a significant way, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things we always talk about is everything that you can catch by way of that approach can be caught passively. You can catch the fraudster who is attempting to manipulate their answers by way of understanding your skip patterns. You can catch the fraudster who wants you to think that they're an IT decision maker and they're not by watching what they answer. You got to monitor that. In the same way that there are services out there right now, if you're astute enough, you're going to have something that alerts you when your credit card gets fraudulently charged. Researchers have to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about the idea of, is this going to get better? It absolutely will get better. I will say outright, I'm not a researcher. I am a business person in the research space that wants to do everything possible to protect the researcher. That's my main intention with all of this, is that you're able to sit down and do your job and still think about fraud, but think about it through your lens versus my lens. You don't need to be the technologist trying to find the deep, dark spaces of the internet.
Right.
You need to be the researcher that takes advice from the person who is going that way, and also understand your partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
Your partnerships need to evolve. In today's world, you have to have fraud as one of the top five things in your mission as a company to prevent from happening. We have to protect what's ours, and research is ours,
mm-hmm.
right? It's ours to perform and perform for some fee. But if there's fraud in it, the fraudster isn't the one getting the pie on the face. You are. So you have to protect your own interest. And again, you don't need to be me. You just need to find people like me and partner with those folks. And it's not just me. There's plenty of us out there that are doing this. The other piece to keep in mind is make sure that they have the same intention as you, right?
Mm.
The intention is a good complete. The intention is a good research.
Yeah.
The intention is not a good click.
Right.
Or even a click. There's a lot to keep in mind with this, but if you get the right partnerships,
mm-hmm.
and you really trust them, you can really just focus on your research and not worry about what's happening in the fraud space, because your good partner will tell you what's going on in the fraud space.
I think this is a really important point for researchers, and then also for anyone who's consuming research, because my friend Paul Saldera at Equation Research, who has also been on the show a couple of times, he and I have talked a lot over the years with each other and with clients about a researcher's least favorite question. Is the sample statistically significant? just like, okay, that's a tell. And listeners, don't worry. I'll do a blog post or something about why that's an irritating question to a researcher. But I think there are a lot of consumers, especially in this year of polling, where you hear commentators talking about this poll is trustworthy because it has 4,000 respondents in it. There's more information here before we can decide whether it's a trustworthy poll. And so the thing that Paul and I have always talked about is the thing you're looking for in a sample of any size in terms of trustworthiness is that it is a randomly selected representative sample. That's the gold standard. And obviously, randomly selected is a thing that is not what's happening in convenience samples, strictly speaking. Then the weight really does rest on the question of representativeness. And if you've got people like your grad student in Bangladesh who's operating a half a dozen identities on different devices, filling out surveys to make an easy $50 a day, you do not have representativeness. And if you don't have that, then you don't have anything else. Just the other day, I was looking at a youth survey commissioned by Snapchat, done by a reputable pollster, the guy who runs the Harvard Youth Poll. I was just scrolling through the findings and got to the back end kind of demographics questions. These are 18 to 29-year-olds that had been surveyed. So right out of the gate, I'm nervous because that's a hard group to sample. And we know there's a lot of bogus responding in 18 to 24 in particular. And so I'm scrolling through. And here's a question about home ownership. Do you rent or do you buy your home? And 49% of them said that they owned their home. And there's just no way. We know this. We know that 18 to 29-year-olds are not at 50% home ownership rates. It's 33%, and most of those are 25 plus.
And like, especially today.
Especially today. But like the average age of first-time home ownership is like 33. So just like straight out of the gate, you should look at that number and be very concerned about everything else in your survey, because that's verifiably wrong. Everything else might look demographically representative, but that is obviously wrong. And so you've got a problem in this sample. It's not an opinion question. It's not which candidate do I like better, or do I like Coke or Pepsi? It's like, do you own a home or do you rent? It's just obviously wrong. And I just went, well, I don't know what to make of the rest of this survey because of that question. And when that happens, as a researcher, the thing that you are is this intermediary between whoever your client or sponsor for the research is and this representative sample of hopefully real people who can teach you something about what your client wants to learn. And you have to be the holder of that trust that the information you're getting is good quality information. And I think one of the things that I have long wondered about, really since the first time an agency brand strategist said, well, let's just use SurveyMonkey to me, which was probably like 2001 at this point, was like, who's taken that survey? Are those really the people that we want to talk to or no? And I think one of the reasons that this kind of winds up being in this blind spot, especially for any qualitative researchers out there, is in the pre-2010 or 11, 12, that period where almost, you know, where 100% of the work was in person, you could sit in the waiting room of the focus group facility and introduce yourself to all the participants and get a feel for who was there for the cash, who didn't really fit the bill, who didn't want to be there, who was openly hostile. You could figure all of those things out and they'd get a phone call or they'd get invited up by the receptionist and sent home with a check and you could get on with your work. And so there was always this sense of the tactile about it. And I think even in qual, we're seeing the bogus respondents seeping in. We're seeing people who say they're in the US when they're not. We see people who, you know, say that they're in the market for X when they know nothing about that market. They're not in that market. I think the other thing that is interesting is what you're gesturing towards. I don't even think you're gesturing towards. I think you're talking about an actual kind of data governance structure for the research industry. And the thing about that is that all of the kind of current data governance stuff has been more like ethical treatment of respondents and respect for their privacy. Every publication I get about anything I might consider to be data governance has been much more focused on how do we treat people respectfully as opposed to how do we verify that they're people. And I think this is going to be a really interesting shift in perspective. Such an interesting kind of pivot point for the business to start to realize that we have a real data quality problem here. And where we have a data quality problem, we have the potential for a real trust problem that exists between us and our clients. And this goes far beyond questions of respecting the respondent's privacy, which is important and we have to do it. But we also have to make sure we're sure that the respondents are the people we want to be talking to.
You're absolutely right on all those points. There's an area that you're starting to get into that we may find that's a debatable area that you and I don't necessarily align on. That's the governance area. There's a question around, should there be regulators in our space, right? And I do not think we're there at this point. That's all opinion, right? And the reason I don't is because I do think that we still need to shake the innovation tree quite a bit. We're seeing a lot of really cool stuff play out in terms of validation schemes, ways that people are protecting for fraud. And usually regulation tends to favor the large.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that idea of favoring the large that right now our industry, especially after the most recent events, needs to think about heavily in terms of favoring those who have been doing it the same way for quite some time and can't really see the ground level of research that's happening in that space. So I do think that we need to let the competitive nature of our industry play out. We're watching it play out. It's all about your perspective, right? If you see it from a certain angle, you can see all this really cool stuff happening. And yeah, you have to scratch away all the bad stuff. And the bad actors are going to be there. There's just basic facts that they're going to be there. And the reason they're there is because there's money there. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's money, there's going to be some kind of bad element that's going to play into that. I wouldn't necessarily call it a compliment, but it is one of the things we've noticed is that our industry just got big. Like in the past 20 years, our industry got big. $80 billion big. That's our global number. So when we think, well, $80 billion industry, that's a pretty large industry. But let's then think about what we're connecting up to in that space. You would think that at this point, we've been hooking up to that large source for more than a decade. And you'd think we would have figured it out by now. But industries don't work that way. It's very difficult unless there's some kind of big tipping moment, such as what happened with Tesla and the auto industry or Amazon and everything that Amazon has disrupted the way they have. Lucid did that. Lucid connected us up to this space, and it was convenient, no pun intended, but it was a convenient way that we could get what we needed because we were really dealing with a big supply issue then. When we start to look at regulating that at this point, there's just not been a good play out of and stabilization of the innovation that's playing out in this space. It's still like wildfire, and we're seeing it. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing that's happening. The thing that isn't good is when researchers need help understanding the pace for which this is happening. They're paying attention to research. They're not paying necessarily attention to the technology that's helping the research get better, right? And I'll say outright, the hidden hero in all of this is the researcher. Because if you've done your job, you've partnered up with the right technologies, you've partnered up with people who have the same intention as you, you've been able to understand how to create a good study for representation of that opinion. And you have to play a role in pulling some fraud out based on what got in after the pre-survey got some of that out, the end survey got some of that out. We always look at it here. We look at it as the researcher has a job to do in this process, and we want to make sure that's as clean and clear as possible to do that job, to make give an opinion as to whether this is an authentic respondent in their intention to give you good feedback on a survey. My job is to get rid of all the fake stuff, get rid of all the stuff that is not supposed to be there, either through showing their hand that they're inauthentic and they've got their development console open, or they're translating in real time, or we're noticing some of the things that we noticed happen over the last 60 days in terms of the connection types that they're using, which is a whole different level of fraud that we're starting to see that's much more organized than what we saw 5 years ago. So you do have a hard job, but what I'm saying in this is do what you did back then, which is create a perspective around what you had to do back then, but just parallel the things into the virtual space that you need to validate when you can. Validate against the answers as much as you can. The thing you talked about with trending on the home ownership is That's first level research, right? Mm-hmm. That's things that the researcher assistant should have been able to catch. But what they're doing is not really trying to align to that. And what I see every researcher that I speak with is that you are aligning to that.
Yeah.
We actually wrote a blog about this, that the researcher is the unsung hero in the industry because they stop bad decisions from being made because they can basically see the nuance to the research.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my job to see the nuance to the research. My job is to create a gate that allows for only good research to get through. And
yeah.
then it goes from there, right? So all this to say, I think that the compliance governance area, the regulation area, I think we're going to find too much suppression against innovation because you've got to sort of hedge in some of these cases. There is a reason why it's called bleeding edge versus leading edge. Bleeding edge does exactly that. It hurts sometimes. It mm-hmm. literally, you're at it for 12 hours and you've moved an inch. And you think your concept is a great concept, so you push forward and you let that sort of inner voice push you forward into something that's a little bit more stable and you, in a way that it helps you help the researcher. Make sure you test before you go live with something. Make sure you test before you're doing live research on that technology. There's a lot of that kind of thing that you have to be really careful with. And make sure you vet your partners, really vet your partners, and take them through your own vetting process. If you don't know what your vetting process is, then there's plenty of people out there that will tell you what a good vetting process is.
I mean, I completely agree that I don't think this is a ripe area for regulators in the sense of a government agency or Congress or something. When I'm thinking about governance, I am thinking about having your own set of internal quality controls and policies and all of that, that's actually taking that seriously. And then I think something else you alluded to earlier as well is that kind of alignment of, which is like everyone's favorite buzzword with respect to AI now, is you want alignment between the model and the user. And I think that's true here. You want alignment with your partners as a researcher for getting good quality data that you can trust. A baseline thing is I want to be aligned with my sample provider that what they are going to provide me is good sample, not just something that looks like 1,000 completes because it returned the complete link at the end. And that's good enough for us, right? Like that in particular was just, I couldn't stop thinking about that from our last conversation, the idea of like, you're just going to give me a row of blanks because you got served a URL. How nice for you.
Right.
And that I'm the one who's expected to go check that. And I've only got X number of days to check that and come back to you and get you to make good. This is insane. And this is the type of governance, I guess, I'm thinking about for the bigger players who have that kind of commercial power to just start redlining these contracts with sample providers and saying like, either we won't work with you or we're not adhering to that as the way that this works. You're responsible for your side of this equation, not us. And that doesn't mean you don't have to look at it. You don't have to police that. But I think there's a lot more to be done in our industry to set up our own, like, what are our best practices here? What do we expect of our partners and vendors? How do we enforce that by contract? And I think my thing, probably because most of my friends from law school went on to do white collar or civil work, is like, how do you not get sued? How do you not get sued by your clients in the case of a sample provider? How do you not get sued by your clients who are the research agencies? Because from a fraud regulator's perspective, you're talking about defrauding. Each individual instance is worth $1, $5.
Right.
It's not enough for them to care about until you can prove that there's an organized crime ring doing it. Then maybe you can get to a large enough dollar amount that it matters. But until you get there, yeah, it's down to us to create our own governance structures and vetting processes for working with sample providers, and then using tools like opinion routes and others to ensure that what we've got is what we paid for.
Yeah, it's a really good point. If you think about the parallel that you just mentioned with, and it's not that I'm an opponent or a proponent of how the sample industry is currently working. It's the industry that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of saying, well, it's the industry we have, so we have to deal with it. It is the structure that we've decided to hook up to. They have to protect their interest as well. The thing that I mentioned up front is their interest is different than yours. So one of the things you talked about is the idea that you work with the sample partners. They do not have the same intention as the mm-hmm. researcher. They do not. They get paid for a click that They do not get paid for necessarily the complete. They get paid for the click. They even get paid for the fraudulent clicks. That's the crazy part about this. And they do because it's the MarTech space. It's the marketing technology space. So when we look at it that way, yeah, you should pick your sample partners in a way that you feel you started that process, but you need someone in between. And anyone out there that thinks that their sample company is in alignment with them, they need to be careful with that, right? Now, there's a little bit of a, there's sort of a middle person or middle entity with that, and that's that if you don't have your own source, right? We don't have a specific source that we built. We work with everybody out there. We cultivate the sources that way, and we understand what's good and bad. We and others who want to protect this process need to have that intention of, I want to make sure that you, Farah, get a good complete. That's my only job, that right. I get the ability for you to trust me because I have that intention. So now we go back to, well, what do we do from here, right? Well, how do we pick our partners properly? It's less about, to me, it's less about picking the partner and more about monitoring their performance. Just the same way as you monitor the interest rate that your credit card is charging you. If you're responsible, you're looking at that, you're looking at your statement, you're seeing if there's fraud on your statement, you're checking your interest rate, you're checking things here and there to make sure that they are working on your behalf. You've got to do the same thing here. If you do not have a sample management partner program that allows you to understand the quality that's being served to you, how much you're blocking, how much you're having to reconcile, how much you're having to not trust your data, because over and over you have to deal with that, then you need to think about changing partners. And that doesn't mean that changing partners is going to get you completely different people. It will not get you completely different people. That it's not different people. It's the different way that they go about their own filtering system, because they do their own thing, right? Mm-hmm. They do their own thing at the level for which their business needs to run. I wouldn't call it acceptable loss. Not anything to do with that. It has to do with their business model and the way they feel they need to filter out. But they are clearly not filtering out enough because it's ending up where it ends up. In that process, I could have the best tool out there and I could have the best measurement inside the survey out there as well. And I can guarantee you that the researcher is going to see something that throws them, that you sort of throws that doubt. But it's the same issue that we saw back to the same parallel. Credit card companies spend billions of dollars trying to get fraud to go away. They have services that do it, and it still ends up on your statement. So money doesn't fix the problem. So it's not as if we can just say intelligence and money, there's not enough of it here. Let's just try to fix it that way. And it's not going to happen. We just have to know that we're going to live with it the same way the credit card industry is living with it and the way the advertising industry is living with it. There's a certain fact to keep in mind about the, what we hooked up to. We're an $80 billion industry, and we hooked up to the advertising technology space that is just under $1 trillion as a global industry, $978 million. They have a 10% problem. Think about what that means. Their fraud problem is bigger than this industry.
Yep.
So we need to sort of think through what that means to us. We're not going to erase it, okay? Right. If you do erase it, you then have to think about how representative you're talking about, because you're not in the public if you're doing that. You're really sort of closing the gates completely, and you may have a hyper-consumer space that you have your loyals. You can absolutely talk to them about your brand and get feedback and do your things, and you likely have a really good representation because they want your product to be better. You want your product to be better. You have a good cohesive line between them. But what happens when you need a general public opinion in the mix, and you need to sort of create a segmentation where you've got non-customers and customers in that mix, right? You've got to go out to the public in that world, and you've got to do it in a way that is just as astute as the person who is charging on their credit card. You got to go to the right sources, the right retail partners, the right everything.
Hi, it's just me. I wanted to take a quick break in this conversation to let you know that I'm not just a podcaster who can't get enough of the technical details of polling. I'm also the founder of a research and strategy consultancy focused on helping leaders get real about their customers and decide to grow. We combine qualitative and quantitative research built on high-quality data, brand marketing, and product-led go-to-market strategy with an eye on the latest in behavioral and marketing science to help brands make big decisions. If you're interested in what we do, you can always get in touch with me at www.thedifferenceengine.co. I hope to hear from you. So, you know, as I've been talking to people in the politics space, it's clear that there is essentially a top tier, which is the use of probabilistic sample with double opt-in, certainly the Pew Research panel that they've built, but also you get there more or less with Ipsos Knowledge Panel, for example. And then you have organizations that are using voter file providers to then do every nth voter random sampling off of a voter file where we have their address, we have their name, we know their voting record. And companies like L2 appending on to that a whole bunch of other consumer data where, like, we really know that they are who they say they are. And then we're contacting them with a phone number we know is theirs, or with a postcard to an address we know that they live at.
Physical binding.
Yeah, exactly. That physical binding. And in the polling space, that's clearly where the stratification has gone. True high-quality polling is done by the organizations that use those tools to find voters. And even there, they have other forms of sample-related bias because of non-response and all kinds of other stuff. But at least they know they're talking to voters. That's where response rates still are a live question because they have to call so many numbers to get anybody to answer the phone. That's its own set of challenges, but that's them. And it's like a handful of, I think, more and more as the pollsters get established and have enough money and have enough reputation, they're able to spend the money that's required in order to use these tools for sample. And then you have all the new entrants, the people who just want to do a flash poll. So there's still plenty of that going on. And as anybody tries to enter the space as a pollster, they start out using convenient sample. They just do.
They have to.
They can't afford to be doing what Pew is doing. As this becomes more apparent through your efforts and others to make it more apparent that this is an issue for the market research business, do we start to move towards some sort of two-tiered system where the richest brands who want the best quality data for certain projects go to companies that are able to provide them verified, tethered to reality sample in this way? Or are we just optimizing around the edges of the convenient sample because it's fast and cheap?
I'm going to answer that with a yes. Because it's already happening in both cases.
Yeah.
Okay. If you have the money for that type of study, let's just say normal study is, you know, $5 CPI, 1,000 people, $5,000. We have some understanding that some of that money is going to end up to the respondent, and we go from there. You have the ability right now to go to a source and get 1,000 respondents and pay not five, but a lot more than five to get that probabilistic approach, to get what you're talking about. They're not trying to conquer the world. They have the same intention as the researcher.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference there, right? It depends on what you want to do with it, right? I mean, there's some companies that say that's the only type of research I want to do if I'm doing primary.
Right.
I don't think there's enough percentage for that to be a mainstream thing. But I also wouldn't necessarily just throw out convenient sample because 10% of it is fraud. And I say 10% because for the most part, what we're noticing is while it has its ebbs and flows, and right now there's a bit more of a spike going on in certain spaces, if you've done everything right and you've got the right intention in terms of the partners that you're working with, you're going to find that your research looks good, right? By way of design, you are getting the answers that you're supposed to be getting. You don't see any really crazy infiltration. And yeah, there's the study here and there. Everybody's got those studies. Everyone has those studies. And it doesn't matter that it's B2B or consumer either, if it spikes. So that's something to keep in mind. But I say all of this because the industry, if it wants double opt-in and it wants to pay triple the price, quadruple the price that it's currently paying, there's going to be plenty of people out there that will provide that to them. And if it keeps purchasing, it's capitalism. So we'll start to blossom that area much more, and research will cost a lot more. And truthfully, it would be a glorious day if I found out that I didn't need to do fraud prevention, because I mean, I've succeeded, right? And these group of people that do this kind of thing aren't needed. That's not going to happen. I see that as sort of a 0.5% chance or less, mainly because of who we're connected up to, what the ecosystem is right now. And it doesn't mean that it's a fraud-based system that we're getting research from. It means that if you don't partner up properly and you don't let technologists do their job, in today's world, a researcher cannot look at post-interview results and catch all the fraud. It is not possible. I've got a blog waiting to go called Unseen Fraud. And that unseen fraud is when you look at an open end and you think it's all good, but you then find out that it was copy and pasted. A copy and paste process is not something that shows up in post-interview unless it's just illogical. Now, if they're just copying and pasting the first thing that shows up in Google so that they can get some words, they're going to get caught. Survey fraud used to have an intention of getting through surveys quickly. Just 5 years ago, it was that way. Okay? That's not the case today. We are making a difference. And here's one odd fact about it. Survey fraudsters aren't copying and pasting because of speed.
Right.
They're copying and pasting because they want a valid answer. Because they have Gen AI sitting over to the side and they're asking Gen AI the question. And 70% of the time, Gen AI comes back with the word keen.
Delve, yes.
Delve, wondrous. All these odd words that it thinks it needs to use, but it's not in everyday phrasing, right? Very easy for researchers to catch that. But it's not going to take long before prompts get just good enough that they can get survey phrasing that's not detectable. You've got to depend on your technology. And that, to me, will change the perspective. When we think about, will it get worse before it gets better? It will get worse and stay worse if you don't change your perspective and include technology and partners that understand the technology of survey fraud and survey taking in general into your space that have the same intention. You've got to pick partners that have the same intention. You've got to know, and they've got to validate their value, and pick partners in the sample space that you also trust, knowing that their job is for clicks, not completes.
Right.
Unless they're using a double opt-in methodology, like you talked about with some of the public polling that is much more premium. There's double opt-in panels out there that you can work with. And you will find that if you use them enough, if they grow enough and they have enough demand, they will not be able to meet your demand.
This is a really important part of understanding this challenge, is that a whole lot of horses have already left the barn. Even talking about like a two-tiered system of sample provision, there are a handful of projects I've worked on in my entire career that I can see making a strong case for using double opt-in and saying, if we don't do this, we will be screwed. Because candidly, which ad campaign do you like better? Probably doesn't need that level of validation and rigor or whatever, but you still need sound study design and you need to verify that you have good completes. But at the same time, it's just, it's not really that high stakes of a decision. I used to annoy my boss at Holland Partners by occasionally saying to Microsoft, okay, so you've shot it already and it's gonna go no matter what happens when we do the test. Isn't it cheaper just to go to market? and find out, you're not going to change anything and it's too late to reshoot. So why are you spending an extra $60,000 to test the idea? But I can imagine some, particularly in healthcare, particularly in like IT decision makers, business decision makers, you're trying to interview the C-suite, very specific groups of people where they really do need to have the role, the condition, the residency. There's certain things where if they don't have all, if all three of those conditions aren't met, then they're not really valid for the study. And yet they have partners that want to use Facebook for recruiting. And that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what that is. For anyone doing geo-restricted, it's geo-restricted, especially in the digital space, by the IP address that's given.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk a tightrope when it comes to the IP address.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. Most importantly, fraudsters know that. They know they can use something called a proxy. And proxies, unto themselves, when they came out, they didn't have a great meaning in the first place in terms of what they did. But it's even worse now with residential proxy. Residential proxy mm-hmm. is the IP address right here, right next to me, right next door, because there's a whole gray market that happens in the first place. So the idea that you are getting that geo-restricted person, you still have to depend on technology to make sure that person's not proxying into that location.
Mm-hmm.
Even the six devices that we talked about with our Bangladesh fund.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about what he did, one of the things he looked for in proxies are proxies that didn't rotate. My IP address hasn't moved, right? So it doesn't move. If you're a normal person, your IP address is your IP address, right? But when you're in a proxy, sometimes they'll rotate them. They'll keep you in the same location, basically, but they'll rotate. And when they rotate, that throws massive doubt by someone like me looking at that,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we understand what's going on. More importantly, it also throws big doubt to the sample company because they're looking at that. Remember I talked about the efforts that they take on.
Right.
They look to see if the IP addresses are changing. That's a pretty significant indication.
Sure.
Right? It's not like they're not doing anything. They're doing a lot. They're the first rough filter. The way to look at this is, you want to drink it straight from the pond or do you want to filter? Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to work directly with the sample company, there's a pretty good chance there's a little bit of a filter on that situation, but you're going to see some cloudiness in your water.
Right.
So when you get it inside your house, most people have a filtration system inside their house.
Right.
You got to do the same thing here. That filtration system is so that you can drink it. If you've got a partner that is thinking the way you think, then you can consume the information that they let through. Just as much as you are thinking about it, the fraudster literally makes a living thinking about it. And it's just an irritant to you. And it's just this thing over to the side until it really hits you hard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things to keep in mind with this is I talked about earlier that you need to monitor your sample partners. It's also important to monitor your studies. Studies, for the most part, you'll see 99 studies go by. And out of the 99, you're seeing 10% block or 15% block. And you're seeing some kind of reconciliation or poor performance.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have that 100 study come through. And it's a large study. And a lot's on the line for it. And you see massive fraud coming through.
Mm-hmm.
You see all kinds of weirdness in your data. And that's because you've expanded your network because it was a big study. You've reached mm-hmm. into spaces that you're not used to. And it's unproven. It's just unproven data for you.
Yeah.
I mentioned all of that, that you've got to pay attention to your studies. Fraud works with the surprise element.
Yeah.
They will absolutely do that. In fact, one of the things they do is they'll start three surveys at the same time so that they know they can get paid for them, right? And they'll do that on purpose because you can't dedupe that situation quite the same way. So there's a lot of that kind of thing going on as well. So you're not needing to worry about that. You just want to watch the percentages of fraud versus not fraud, right? And if you're working with a good partner that deals with that, they are going to give you that information readily, mm-hmm. real time. And so that you can look at that by the hour, by the day, by the week, by the phase that's going on in your project. And you should not see some massive spike. If you see a massive spike in the pre-portion of your survey, you've got to really pay attention to what just happened because fraud leaks in. If you pour a gallon in and two drops get in, what happens when you pour 10 gallons at the same time? More comes in, right? More of that process comes in.
Yeah.
And we are noticing that there's just some studies, they get more fraud
mm-hmm.
and a lot more fraud. And mm-hmm. by the way, if you don't have technology that's protecting you, you can absolutely guarantee 100% guarantee that you are on the fraudster's radar. Mm-hmm. They know that they can make
that
money.
You're a soft target. Yeah.
Right. You are absolutely an easy target.
It's also really interesting to think about. So one horse is the programmatic advertising as a method of getting sample in order to make more studies fillable and speed things up and drive down price. All of those things are nominally to the good. Second horse that follows that horse is more surveys, just loads more surveys in the market at any given moment by any kind of company. It's not all P&G anymore. It's every startup. It's anybody who can cobble together a few $100.
It's what we're told in college. Get feedback about your product. Get feedback, right? Understand what's going on with your service. Understand what's going on with your people. How do you personify your people so that you can cater your message towards them so that they understand your product better? All those things that I just mentioned are research bound. So we are told very early on that we need to get feedback. We're even told as toddlers to get feedback, right? So when you get to be an adult and you're in business, feedback is a natural occurrence. It should be done. It's just this industry is a big industry that has bad actors, just like any other big industry with bad actors.
Well, and with the rise of various tiers of ResTech that now exist, you have more access to research for, let's say, academics who tend not to have large research budgets to use online tools for conducting research and buying sample online. And I've talked to a couple of academics who are struggling with this issue of clearly finding a lot of fraud in their studies. You have this with startup pollsters. You have it with startups, their own internal product teams trying to figure out what anybody makes of their idea or a keyframe or whatever. You've got ad agencies who no longer have research departments. We got rid of those, I guess, when we started importing planners or something. I don't know when that shift happened. There used to be researchers in ad agencies. And now they don't have research budgets. They can't claw it from their clients. So they're kicking a little money here and there to do some guerrilla research in order to get any kind of grounding to develop a creative idea. Everybody's spending money in this space. And the other thing that I think that some of these platforms, these ResTech companies have done, is basically try to do like SaaS model for unsophisticated research buyers as a sales play, where it's like there is a self-service tool. You can come straight to me, the sample provider, and we have a dashboard, and you want us to run your survey for you? We can do that. You have your own tool you want to use, and you just need a token to plug the sample into the SurveyMonkey or the Qualtrics or whatever it is. We can give you that. And, oh, look, we've provided you with a pretty dashboard that you can use to look at crosstabs. And yet, these are not sophisticated research buyers who don't know how to tell when a complete is really a complete. And so they're fiddling the dials on something that's 10% trash. They don't know the difference. And to your point, like all they know is they need to go get feedback. So they go get feedback. I think there's just such an interesting kind of set of layers here. And then to something else we talked about last time, just like the slog we are making actual people go through in order to complete our surveys is also a problem, right? Like the kind of easier it is to field, the more likely we are to like kitchen sink the thing and toss in a whole bunch of questions that have no place in the study.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm really glad you brought that part up, because one of the things that it's what I call the human element, right? In this digital world we live in, the human element needs to be a part of every process, right? So the human element involved in that part is that, as an example, the Insights Association is working through a participant's Bill of Rights.
That's great.
And that's going to show through to the research agencies. Will that show through to the ad agency that's got the intern doing a market research study? Likely not. But the whole point there is that intern is likely going to give a 5-minute survey, hopefully.
Hopefully.
But we absolutely need to think that through. You have to be really careful about who you're using, period. Even the Insights platforms that you're talking about, and there's a ton of them. They all came out all at once, right? And there's some good ones and bad ones out there, but in all of them, if you're using them, researchers, you need to understand what their stance is when it comes to fraud prevention. If what they are saying is that they depend on the source to take care of that for them, that's a huge red flag. That's a massive red flag. That's the same thing as hooking up to the pond and drinking the water and thinking it's good. It's you have to be really careful with that idea. You also have to know that if they are using someone, what's the intention of the fraud prevention partner they're using? Who is it? it's not like there's a massive amount of partners in this space. So right. You can pretty much understand who's who. When we get to the human element of the researcher, researcher plays a role in every part of that. Only the researcher can understand and have the intuition that's not a really good answer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good insight. They thought about their open ends, mm-hmm. right? When we stick the human element back into what's going on, you start to, in a surprising way, sarcasm, you'll start to see really good research. You don't need to be spending massive amounts of money to find out whether they like the color red or blue on that message,
mm-hmm.
right? Just own it and move it forward because you're the expert. Make the expert opinion and move it forward, as
right.
opposed to thinking that the research is going to cover you, CYA. But in the end, the human element has to play a role. Even to the point that when we start to get into the subject, and I'm going to go ahead and bring it up, even when we get into the subject of synthetic response, the human element plays a massive role in that.
Mm-hmm.
How do they model all of that stuff?
Yeah.
Right? And is that stuff yet to be determined? Can you really do research using synthetic respondents? You can. I have to be really careful with this because I do think that there's a place for it. There's absolutely a place for synthetic response, but we have to tread methodically through the process because we're researchers. We want to see how it does or doesn't help us. There's a few applications I'm already seeing that it would be perfect for, right? It would be amazing for secondary research, absolutely, because you can get a lot of subjects taken care of all at once by doing some queries and doing them correctly to where you're getting what you think is historical information on the same subject, and you can move that forward in preparation. But history has always told us we like to talk to humans, regardless of how we're talking to them, where we're pushing a button, texting, having a survey online, calling them on the phone, talking to them one-on-one. There's the human interaction. We like talking to other humans, just as people, and researchers especially do. There is a need for synthetic response. There is a need for human element to be a part of that synthetic response. There is a need in every one of the phases for the human element to play a role. But I'll be the first to say that if you can automate it, you should. Because when it really gets down to where we make a difference as a human, it's the intuition. It's that thing that is the magic of the human being able to give a good answer or see it as a good answer. And when it's synthetic response, what you're getting as an answer, right?
Yeah.
It looks fake.
It looks fake, yeah.
And again, there's those services, that's where you're finding the leading and leading edge right now, is in that space, and they will find their space. Absolutely. It's just, there's a lot of naysaying. I think the way I look at it is let studies prove this. Let studies prove the technology, because that's what we do as researchers.
Yeah.
As an industry, we prove things out. There's a theory, there's a hypothesis, there's a source of truth. We go to the source of truth. We then know whether we've proven our theory or not, and we move it forward, right? Do the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. And there's a lot of that happening right now that's proving and disproving, but you've got to go in with no intention to disprove or prove. It's just like a normal researcher would.
Yeah. As a researcher, I would much rather talk to a person. It's easier for me. But it's also harder. It takes time. It takes money. All of those things are true. The thing that I think is interesting right now about synthetic response is, like, it's everything else with generative. What's the training model and what's the reference data? And if you're trying to just sort of answer a question that doesn't need a set of training data that's less than 2 years old in order to be good, then
that's
go for
really
it.
That's a really good poignant moment.
Right?
Right? That's the big...
Then go for it.
I do think that there's companies out there that have invested massively in, not in synthetic response, but massively in all the research they have. We can pick the Procter & Gamble's and Coca-Cola's and the Pepsi's. They have massive amounts of data that I know what they're doing with it. Stuffing it into an LLM, and they're hopefully getting some direction on that's good secondary research. When you want to create the research for the human, you don't want to waste their time. If we're going to waste their time by routing them through 15 surveys before they get to the survey they're supposed to get into, then we have a real issue on our hands when it comes to just making sure that we acknowledge the participants mm-hmm. that want to take surveys, that we keep them.
Yeah.
As much of a commodity as we have treated the participant, we've got to understand that they're now going to become premium.
Yeah.
They're not premium in cost, premium in the fact that we have synthetic response to be able to help us on some of the secondary research. We have the ability to get to pretty much any place in the world in terms of being able to get feedback from someplace in the world. And in that mix, we've got to make sure that the bad element doesn't creep in. Again,
right.
It's just make it part of everything you think about. You don't need to become a broad expert. It's not a space that is for the meek, that's for sure. What I've found in the space is that I know I'm helping by critically reviewing the data that I'm reviewing on an hourly, daily, monthly basis. I know that what I'm finding is the garbage that shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather it be me that find it.
Right.
One of the things I used to talk about all the time is you cannot make the most premium people in your agency, the researcher, you can't make them the janitor. Don't make them clean all your trash out, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's data. Get it as clean as you can possibly get it. At the very least, get the fraud out of it. And then from there, source manage to good participation.
We're on a really nice positive trajectory. And of course, my brain did what it does, which is says, are we worried in the short term? As the word gets out that this is happening and that we need to be more careful about all of it, about the length of our surveys, about which partners we trust, and then how we validate them. And we start to pull in more of these, you know, fraud and quality control pieces into kind of research operations. Are there any kind of short-term looming threats? I think about other things in the kind of world of programmatic where it has been used not just to make a quick buck, but to manipulate people, manipulate companies, manipulate governments in some instances. And I'm curious if that's something you think is a risk here.
I think it's a needed concern. When I went after the idea, this aspirational idea, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to make an impact in the space. That was my intention.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose a subject that I was passionate about, but also concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew the very first thing that needed to happen is to make people aware of it. There's surely a small amount of people that are experts in this space. And that subsegment can't pull the whole industry along. So
mm-hmm.
when you make the industry aware of some of those dark alleys that are there,
mm-hmm.
the industry is going to appropriately get concerned. And everyone then thinks, well, geez, how much time do we have left? Well, we've been at this for about 10 years. You're just coming into this at this moment.
Yeah.
So the idea of having short concern isn't quite what it is. It's that you just found out.
Yeah.
And you're
yeah.
just starting to understand that representative to the world, there's bad people. And it's just that simple,
mm-hmm.
right? I am concerned on one note, and that's that people don't heed the advice of the experts. And that they just say, my partner hasn't been giving me fraud all along. I checked my stuff at the end of my study. There's so much wrong with those two statements that it's hard to take that person out of their current space and their current cadence
mm-hmm.
of research and put them in a space that gets them to understand how they need to react today and respond today,
mm-hmm.
right? That is the short concern that I have. Is that people keep doing it the same way they've been doing it
yeah.
for the last 5 years, even 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
5 years, you could say 10, but everybody knows that there's so much that's changed in 10 years.
Yeah.
I have recommendations that I would make today
mm-hmm.
that I didn't know that I needed to make even a year ago. So it's that evolutionary, it's still evolutionary in the process. Is it moving fast? Anything in tech moves fast, and it moves faster than we can comprehend as humans. And that's one of the reasons why AI has such a warning label on it,
mm-hmm.
that it can move much faster than us. It's been proven that if given the right questions, AI will lie 96% of the time. And what my immediate response to that was, well, that's just the evolution of maturity. AI has to grow up. And it is growing up right in front of us, not quite the same as a toddler, But we're not going to comprehend how quickly it goes. And when it goes past us, that's the moment that we need to understand how to manage it better. We're not far from that. That is the short-term issue that I think we've got right now, is in the operational space, people who don't heed the experts' opinion in terms of how they need to incorporate new things into their world that they weren't incorporating into their world even 5 years ago. Fraud prevention being one of them. Sample partnership management is another. Don't just blindly follow your sample partner. Understand what they're doing, because their intention, again, is not yours. And lastly, because AI has busted in the door and it's here, whether we like it or not, we have to understand its impact. Survey fraudsters are using it to copy and paste intelligent answers, and they'll get better at that. Mm-hmm. We're going to get better at using it for getting the right questions to ask, when we need to ask questions, and doing the right secondary research. But all of that is on the short-term note. There's going to be a lot of companies that fall off the edge. If they're not paying attention to how sample companies work today, they are at risk. It is their main blind side. It's like covering up your whole windshield and then thinking you're going to drive. Right. You're driving by the rearview mirror. You have to know you're going to hit something, and it will likely damage your brand image, your reputation. Mm-hmm. It will do some serious damage to everything around you. If you just pay attention to blogs and podcasts like this, they really matter. I'm here explaining this to you with one intention, to make sure other people hear it. Because if they hear it, at least I know that they hear it enough. It's not just about Rich Ratcliffe saying it. Mm-hmm. I said it and then they hear it from five other people. That probably means they should do something about it.
Yeah.
That is the short-term concern I've got.
It's interesting to think about the waves of evolution here, of going from a place where only a few companies could afford data to everybody and get data one way or the other, to wait a second, we need some quality controls on this data. And now the emergent thing is being able to sort of make data out of what we already know and a handful of hallucinations along the way. But your point about secondary is very interesting, because we do some projects where we wind up saying, you have a question about something that was not the focus of the last five studies we did for you, but we did ask about it. And we could just go back into that data because it's not that old and work up a model of how people think about this thing. We don't actually have to go interview people again. And that's the benefit of having a small cadre of repeat clients. But it's not easy work, because it's largely qual. And anything really interesting in the survey related to this is going to be in the open ends. So getting something to help us sift through all that unstructured data has been the dream of my career, is like, how do I go back in to pre-existing research and make sense of it in a way that's even remotely cost-effective for time and therefore cost-effective for our clients.
And there's technology for it. There's absolutely technology that will allow you to do that today. That's the thing about this process, is that it's very difficult sometimes to get into a subject and feel like you're missing something. You know, you may be missing some technology that would allow you to do it quicker, but you've got to get it done, right? You've got to get whatever this thing is done. And this idea of partnerships and technology, partnerships and research, you can likely name 10 people in your partnership list in terms of people who you would say, I need to get their feedback about this research, about how I'm doing this research. If you've got questions about it, right, how you need to do it. There seems to be, it is decreasing over time, but there seems to be less of a desire to do that in technology partnerships. It's either intimidating or not fun.
Yeah.
Either one, right? That keeps you from understanding what's happening, so where you can just do your job in the way that you want to do it and make money at it as well. I think that it all goes back to, as a researcher, you don't need to be doing that part. You don't need to try to work through where all the technology is. You do need to try to find the partners that can give you some idea and trust who you need to trust in that space.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important things. And that's why I feel one of the areas that will start to play out, both short-term and long-term, are partners that absolutely have your intention, but they're not doing research, right? Everything they're doing is on behalf of you as a researcher.
Right.
And that is a model, I think, that will play out more and more. It's the model I'm in.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a model that I feel as a non-researcher coming at this.
Mm-hmm.
While I surely understand everything around the method, I ran a research agency. Running a research agency teaches you quite a bit about mm-hmm. knowing that you can hire someone to do that thing, mm-hmm. whatever that thing is. In this case, it was research. So I hired the researchers that I trusted could do the job that I needed them to do and do it better than anything I had seen before. And I feel like it worked. Trust in your intuition, because that's what you do as researchers, to find partners in technology
mm-hmm.
to help you do your job better, and including fraud. You don't need to be worrying about fraud. You need to be worrying about the research that's at hand.
Yeah. And I think that's really useful for researchers in thinking about how you start to construct your new kind of rubric for evaluating partners.
Right.
And that's, it's not just price. It's not just what's convenient to you, who can spool it up as quickly as the client is asking you to go, or all of those kind of time and money pressures are always going to be there. The question is, all right, you suffered through one project, in between this project and the next project, find a good partner that you feel like you can rely on. The very simple baseline question of, what are their intentions? It's a good question for any partner. It's a good question for vetting partners here. And I think that's something that I'll cop to, was not something on my mind previously. It was, I know that other companies I work with this company. And that fits my budget, and that fits my timing. Sounds good. Let's go. Now I have a whole different list, different checklist to operate from. Do you have any kind of final thoughts, any final advice for researchers, whether in public polling or market research, in thinking about data quality and sample quality specifically?
It goes back to the partnerships. One of the things to think about with a researcher of today is that if your passion is research, designing studies, staying in the data, pulling out opinion and feedback to create recommendation and analysis, there's a pretty good chance you're also not a data collection expert in modern day terms. And I say modern day terms because there's a lot of things that data collection experts think through. And if you've got an internal operations group, they should be telling you what they're thinking through.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not monitoring their sample partnerships, that's a pretty good example of one of the things you need to really see as, at the very least, a cautionary flag. If you're a consultant and you're working with a data collection partner, you need to be asking them the same questions. How do they monitor fraud? How do they prevent it? Who do they use? Do they just depend on their sample partners? So I think some lasting thoughts on this is, we're going through, I've been in this now for close to 3 decades. And last time I saw something quite as evolutionary as what's going on right now, is what I saw when online hit.
Mm.
When online hit, everything changed out, right? There was a lot of scattering happening, a lot of people coming up with new models and a lot of new stuff that was happening in online. And a lot of the systems that the insights industry still use were designed back then, right? And they worked back then, but it doesn't work today. So you've got to understand some of the newer models and get comfortable about the idea of vetting your partners that you work with. In the end, yeah, they may be your friends, but they've got to provide a good value so that you can provide a good value to your clients. If you're not a technologist, you better have some technologists around you, because mm-hmm. they need to help you survive what's going on. You cannot review data post-interview in today's world and think you caught all the fraud.
Yeah.
It's just not possible. That's a sword to die on. There's no possible way that someone can look at things like IP address and browse and user agents and think that they're going to catch what they need to catch for the pre-survey activities.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be able to look at open ends after the study's done and think that they've caught all the fraud there either. It's just like anything else in today's world. You've got to monitor the process for the unseen things mm-hmm. that are happening, because it's very visible when you start looking at that stuff. Focus specifically on that partnership process and the human element. Stop taking the human out of the human research that we're doing. These automation systems, they only work if they get driven by human opinion, either by modeling
mm-hmm.
or process orientation of the data that's being collected. It's one of the most important things to think about. And as things come up, like synthetic response, you've got to do what you do as researchers, research it.
Mm-hmm.
And see if it works for you. and talk to the experts, who you think are experts. This is a very much a human connection industry in so many ways, right? Data science may be a little different because you're sitting and you're looking at terabytes of data nonstop, and you may not see a human all day as you look through the matrix of information you're looking at. But market research is a human connecting industry. We are connecting to the human to understand their feedback. We're connecting with partners to understand their expertise in the space. And not much has changed when you start looking at the generalized idea of it. Just do it the same way. Just create your partnerships in a way that you know that they really are protecting you in terms of what's going on behind the scenes, and bring out the trust in the process. I say trust not lightly. It's in my title. I have to look at it differently when I look at trust. Trust in privacy, confidentiality, it's all that stuff. I need to trust that when I'm talking to you, that you're going to represent me in this podcast, right?
Right.
You need to trust that I'm going to give you good information and prepare. The same thing happens with us trusting the respondents, us trusting our partnerships, and so on. All that to say, make sure that you modernize. I'm really careful with that word. I don't want people to think that it's just all zeros and ones, because it's not. You do need to, if you haven't evaluated the way you do research and you're still doing concept tests the same way, using the same partners, it'd be a good idea to start auditing what you're doing to make sure that you're getting good information on the process.
I think it's a perfect place to leave it. If people want to keep up with what you are doing at Opinion Route and what you're working on elsewhere, what's the best way for them to find you or get in touch with you?
Well, there's LinkedIn always. It's Rich Ratcliffe at Opinion Route. As far as my email address, I don't mind people just emailing me directly, and that's rratcliffe@opinionroute.com. I am always up for a good conversation like this. That's how this happened, Farah. I'm always up for debate when it comes to what's the right thing to do, because I think that's the way we find our opinions. And watch what we're doing with our blogs. Watch what we're doing at Opinion Route when it comes to the technology that we're out there with. Our intention outright is around protecting the market research process. We know that the job that all of you have is not an easy one, and it's not an easy one in a shifting landscape of today. And because of that, we want to be available to have these conversations about sample, have these conversations about protecting your survey and your research. It's what we get paid to do. So find me on LinkedIn, please reach out, and I'll be happy to have the same type of conversation about what you bear.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.